8:15 having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order. And I had some requests, Representative Hertaus, that you should be chairing all the meetings from now on because it seemed to move quite quickly yesterday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to make that comment, suggesting that with my presiding and your presenting, we made record time. Two bills in 6 minutes, I thought was pretty good.
My bills seem to have tires on them. They move very quickly here and on to other committees. Representative Quam.
So moved.
Representative Quam, we don't have a quorum yet. So but you know, that I was thinking about that, and I remember my first year. I was a minority member on the Education Policy Committee, and Representative Erickson, you'll remember Chair Harry Maris. And the first two or three meetings, because I, as a freshman, he and I were the only ones in the committee room for the first 7 minutes before the meeting started. So, but I remember about the third or fourth meeting, he had a bill to present, and he said, Representative Marquardt, would you come up here and chair? And I remember that very much. And he was quite a person, quite a chair. He did. And I remember he would pick on me every once in a while. And one question he asked, and I'm going to ask the committee this. And I actually got this right, although I had to kind of guess on two of the states, but I wound up getting it right. But his question was, name the four states that have presidents' names as their capital cities in the order of admission into the Union.
Oh, good grief.
So let's tip. Representative Seltzer, do you have any of them? Do you have, or I mean,
that have their
have
capital
presidents' names as the capital city, and then put them in order in which they were admitted into the Union?
Nebraska.
Okay, you have Lincoln, Nebraska, Jefferson City, Missouri.
Madison,
Wisconsin, and there's one more southern state has a. Earlier president, I hear it, Jackson, Mississippi. And so the order of admission was Mississippi, and then I'd remembered the Missouri, I knew that had to be early, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, and then Wisconsin was before us, and then of course you had the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, so that helped kind of put it, and so it goes Mississippi, what do we say, Missouri. Wisconsin, yeah, and Representative Mayers asked that question in the committee. That
one really is an education committee.
It truly is. Yes.
Were you a history teacher?
Yes.
Okay.
But I still had the Mississippi and the Missouri one. I really didn't know, but and then I also taught. Minnesota history, so I knew Wisconsin was the year before we became a territory. So they were 1848; they became a state, and then we became a territory in 1849. And then Representative Quam.
Since we have a quorum, can I renew my motion?
We've got to move on to the first bill, Representative Quam. We are.
I was actually hoping that Representative Hertaus would have been recognized on the floor last night. We might have got out of there sooner.
Oh. That is good. All right. Well, we are covering. We're going to do House File 1103 first because they also have to scoot over into the Senate. So, Representative Newton, would you like to move your bill?
Yes.
Okay. We're still one short, I guess, of the quorum. So we'll do it later. So go ahead and explain your bill. And are there any? I don't see any amendments on this bill. So
there are
proceed.
No amendments, Mr.
Very good.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, House File 1103 creates a minimum amount of compensatory revenue for each school district equal to $1,600 per free and reduced price eligible student, and it's an increase. It'll cost roughly $54 million in the first year and $58 million in the second year. I have with me Superintendent Denny Carlson from Anoka Hennepin, who would like to testify on behalf of the bill.
Thank you very much. Superintendent Carlson, please proceed and introduce yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Denny Carlson, Superintendent of Anoka Hennepin School District. I'm also, Mr. Chair, willing to give social studies credit, given the excellent presentation we just had, just for those of you that are interested in that. The The compensatory formula needs a permanent fix. The compensatory formula does not work for Anoka Hennepin because of the high concentration factor and the size of our schools. We have four elementary schools with more than 1,000 students. We have middle schools near 1,900 and high schools near 3,000 students. We build big schools because they are the most efficient to operate and what our citizens have been willing to support in bonded debt. We are short millions each year for what we need in compensatory programs, student support services, and interventions. We have 12,520 students that are poor. That's 34% of our students, poor with free and reduced status. We have the third highest number of poor students in the state, behind only Minneapolis and St. Paul. If we continue the trend of the past three decades, we will equal the current poverty rate in Minneapolis by 2023. Yet we receive only $12,099 above the regular per student formula, so almost $1,300 for each poor student, while St. Paul gets twice that amount for each poor student. Also, for reference, Minneapolis gets about $2,475 and Osseo gets $1,774. Again, we get just under $1,300. Also, the flexibility we were given in the compensatory pilot legislation is critical to us. We want to continue that local control so we can focus on academic performance in all our schools, use data-driven best practices, which we know work, direct compensatory dollars where they are needed the most, and narrow the achievement gap even more. We currently have one of the lowest achievement gaps in the state in reading. We very much appreciate the seven-year bipartisan support we have had from the House and Senate. The last two governors, as you know, one a Republican, one a Democrat, have both also recognized the unfairness of the current formula towards Anoka Hennepin. We hope you will once again support our 12,500 students in poverty. We do know this is a tough budget year, but we also know that we should be treated in a fair and uniform manner with other school districts that have many children in poverty. We would ask for your support of Representative Newton's bill. We think the best long-term solution for most school districts is to continue to raise the compensatory base as the costs for serving students in poverty increase. Mr. Chair, I'll also save you some time with Executive Director Scott Kroonquist. Associated Metropolitan School District supports this bill. They have 37 districts which represent about half of the student population in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Carlson. Before I look to you, Representative Erickson, I'm going to have Mr. Strom. You mentioned the concentration factor.
Right.
Mr. Strom, would you talk about that and how that really maybe works against a district like Anoka Hennepin, please?
Mr. Chair, members, the school formula for compensatory revenue is calculated at the site level. And as Superintendent Carlson mentioned, that means that the ratio, the percent of students eligible for free and reduced lunch at each school site is what is counted. As Mr. Carlson pointed out, as school sites get larger, essentially what happens is you're washing out richer and poorer areas. And the way the compensatory formula works is if you had two small schools, one with 400 pupils with 20% students of poverty and the other with 60% students of poverty with the same pupil count, you would get twice as much compensatory revenue than if those students were combined in one school with 40% poverty. And the reason for this is because the compensatory formula is a concentration formula. And that means that as the percent of free and reduced lunch students goes up in each district, so too is the amount of funding per free and reduced lunch student. So in other words, if you look at the printout that's in front of you, if you look at a free and reduced lunch student in the Minneapolis School District, for example, because they're close to the top of the list there, you can see that their concentration is 63.1%. They're going to get more than the proportionate increase over a district like Anoka, which has a 28.5% concentration, because it's per free and reduced lunch student that the formula goes up for under a concentration formula. So what happens essentially is that the revenue is dependent on the concentration at the site, and anything that washes out the difference between sites will lead to a lower level of compensatory.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strom. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Newton, I know this is good for many of our school districts, certainly most of mine, but instead of a Band-Aid approach, did you consider any kind of reform that could occur in the compensatory avenue, that wouldn't punish, for example, Minneapolis-St. Paul, because often that's what happens with the compensatory?
Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, it's very hard to do. You know, you have to build it up gradually, and there's always the question of insufficient funds to do it. I think this is one good approach by setting a base and, you know, hopefully continuing to raise that base. But so many of our districts are at a disadvantage because of the way this formula has been designed.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, are there winners and losers in this from your point of view?
Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, there are no losers. There, you know, winners, I don't know if you'd really call them winners. It's districts that would be giving a fairer compensation for their students.
Representative Quam. Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for the testimony. And Superintendent, I'm sorry I can't remember your last name, but I always enjoy your testimony. You testified before already. And what were those figures on on your school district's this guy's going to take a picture of me. I just want to look like I'm smiling. No. The what were those figures on the poverty rate increase that you quoted? For Noka
Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Grunhagen, we are doubling in both our students of color and poverty every decade. I've been there almost three decades, and that's been consistent in all those three decades. And what I'm saying is if that trend continues by 2023, we will equal the current poverty rate in Minneapolis,
which is over
about 66%.
So you basically would be at...
Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you'd basically be at... equal to what the Minneapolis is now.
Mr. Carlson, yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Sam Grunhagen.
Any idea what's driving that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, population movement from the south. Our district extends all the way from Brooklyn Park to Brooklyn Center, Dayton and Champlin to the north, up to Ham Lake, Andover, and Ramsey. And the poverty and the... diversity is moving in from the south, and I suspect it'll continue at the rate it's been going. I don't know if it'll double, but that's certainly the trend we've had in the past 30 years.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just Representative Newton, I like this bill. It does a good job for my district. So we got a little bipartisanship going here. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm thinking along the lines of Representative Erickson about, you know, the formula itself and whether we should be looking more broadly. I'm interested in what research the original formula might have been based on. You know, obviously there's a logic to the concentration of poverty causing, more compound circumstances for districts to deal with. And I think if we're looking at... slowly eroding that formula as a base, we need to think about the research that it might have been founded on, and maybe someone can enlighten us about that.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Strom.
Okay, Mr. Strom,
history lesson here.
This would be the second history lesson today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinert, the compensatory formula has been with us in one form or another for more than 35 years. And much of the research it was originally based on dates back to that point in time. And the formula has gone through numerous twists and changes since then. The up until the mid-90s, the count was actually children from families who were eligible for AFDC. I think one way to think about it is that the variable that's being chosen is a proxy variable. It's not that... free and reduced lunch contributes to a child's learning status, but we know that socioeconomic status matters, and that's one of the proxies that we have good information on a district-by-district basis with. In terms of the concentration element, I don't think there's been much that's looked at this in recent times, but back some 30 years ago, the arguments were essentially that there are certain levels where concentration makes a difference. So perhaps having one child with extra needs in a classroom, extra learning needs in a classroom, wouldn't make much difference. Having five children may make a fair amount of difference, and having 10 children would make a great deal of difference. So that was the original nature of the argument, that some level of concentration mattered. In terms of the formula itself, though, our as I said before, our count originally was based on AFDC counts. At one time, it was actually part of what we called total pupil units, and it was built right into the enrollment number that we counted. It got separated out into a separate component and then switched from AFDC to free and reduced lunch. So we've had a number of changes to that formula. One other aspect of that that's probably worth mentioning, on the printout in front of you, you'll see that we count free lunch students as 1.0 for this formula and reduced price lunch students as 0.5. Free lunch keys off of 130% of the federal poverty guidelines, and reduced price lunch 185%. So there's a whole number of policy choices before we even get to the concentration level. And then on the concentration level, the scale that was designed essentially when that was put in place was to match in some ways the level of differential that was there because of the AFDC count in the mid-90s. So that I don't think there's any research to say that that's the right amount of concentration, that it's too much or too little. But that was a conversion at that time that held the formula kind of similar to where it was before, when the count changed from AFDC kids to free and reduced lunch count.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we probably can't answer this today, but I have concern about what the legitimate connections are between the formula and student achievement and improving the circumstances for students in more difficult environments, and if the concentration formula really does reflect a research-based decision. I think we need to be aware of that. If we're trying to level things off for districts that are, in terms of numbers, having difficulty, and yet if the concentration is a legitimate issue, we don't want to undermine that. That's my concern.
Very good. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, perhaps this, I'm not sure if this question is for you, but it might be for Mr. Strom, so I'm just going to play a little ping pong, if that's all right. Mr. Strom, what is the requirements for those to apply for free lunch and free and reduced lunch?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, it's set on family income. As the size of the family grows, the amount of income goes up. So it's a dollar amount set by the essentially keying off family income. In the guidebook, there's a table that has the current year amounts for a family of four. I don't remember offhand what those are. I'll look those up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Strom?
Yeah.
And what exactly does a family need to do? I mean, actually, I think I'm not sure I completely know this answer, but I...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, there's a couple of things that happen, but generally what happens is a school district, and Superintendent Carlson can speak to how they do this in Anoka, but essentially what happens is school districts send out an information form that requests whether the family income qualifies or not. There are also some matching techniques school districts can use to match to things like the nutrition program called the SNAP program, but perhaps Superintendent Carlson would speak to what they do in Anoka. But my understanding is that most school districts will send a form home several times in order to have a family identify its income to see if they qualify for free or reduced price meals.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You want to continue?
McDonald.
Thank you. So a family fills out a form based upon the number of members living in the household. Any information for their income, I presume, would be on there. They have to be in that federal poverty level of 138 to what, 200 and what's the 138
to what? 185%.
138 to 185. And then who verifies that information? Is the school district, they have a certain procedure? Are they mandated, or is it just by the form and their, what's the procedure on that?
Yeah.
Mr. Strom or Mr. Carlson, who wants to?
Mr. Chair.
Who verifies?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a couple of things. Yeah, we spot check. We don't check everybody. We do spot checks. The other thing is that process works much better at the elementary level, not so well at the middle school and high school. It's just harder to get families Our families, not unlike yours, have a lot of pride. To sign off on that to some folks is an indication that they're poor. And so that's a hard to get accurate numbers at the middle school and high school, much easier, and we have higher numbers at the elementary. And we know they're coming from the same families in some cases, and then we have that information for the families, which helps. But if you have a singleton going through middle school or high school, that's tough.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, well, here's where I see, and probably I hope those who've been on this committee identify a problem, that as we continue to pour more money into free lunch, free and reduced lunch students, compensatory funding, I think that we ought to look at the tightening up the eligibility, or at least strengthening that. And I say that with this, when I met with folks in my district just this past weekend, had a great lunch at some of my school districts in Wright County. It was on Friday, so unfortunately I was forced to eat salad and not the meat, but anyway. They testified to me and shared with me they know many family members who don't necessarily qualify, but yet the school has to oblige with the information that the family's providing, meaning there's no way to validate if they truly do qualify. Matter of fact, some students that I was told by my districts, the lunch ladies, so to speak, knew that they didn't qualify. But there's no way for them to, they don't deny them lunch, they don't deny them the qualifications to qualify. So I'll just end in saying this, if we don't tighten up the restrictions and or at least validate those who are applying for the free lunch or the free reduced lunch for the eligibility status, and we continue to offer good programs, maybe perhaps like yours, Representative Newton, your good bill, I think we're going to go into a serious financial crisis. And if we're not validating eligibility based upon the free lunch and free reduced lunch, I think we're going to have a continued problem on our hand with lack of funding.
Thank you. From Mr. Strom, I received some information here. From 130% of poverty to 185% is 30,000 income, family income, to 42,600 income, roughly in that range. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I let me start with a question for Mr. Strom. I'm trying to better understand the concentration factor. We tend to talk about free and reduced lunch as if those are the same things. And in fact, if you qualify for free lunch, you're in serious poverty. And when we lump them together, I think we miss what deep poverty means for kids in terms of their life experiences and opportunities. Minneapolis, 65% free and reduced lunch, but 60% of that is deep poverty, kids who qualify for free lunch. So I'm trying to understand how the concentration factor would work in Representative Newton's bill. Can you help me understand? Because I'm seeing some fairly stark differences in impacts on school districts.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom. Representative Dabney, if you look at the printout on the line for the Anoka School District, you'll see 38,403 pupils enrolled in the fall 2012 count of students. Those that qualify for free lunch are 9,483. Those that qualify for reduced price lunch are 2,919. And as you pointed out, the difference between free and reduced in a district like Anoka compared to Minneapolis is quite different. But essentially what happens next in the formula is that reduced lunch column counts as half and not whole. So you're adding 9,483 to half of 2,919 to get the free and reduced lunch percentage for the Anoka School District. So the 28.5% reflects that those children that qualify for reduced price lunch are only generating as much as half of the child who qualifies for free lunch. Then it goes through the concentration part of the formula, which says what percentage of students at that site qualify for free and reduced price meals. And the higher percentage at that site, the more per free and reduced price student that each student generates. So that's essentially how the concentration gets it built into the formula. And on the spreadsheet here, you can see essentially what's happening is a base is being established that brings districts up to a level where each free and half reduced price meal lunch student generates the $1,600. So it's bringing a floor up, essentially, not affecting the concentration above that level. If you look at the third to last column, you'll see that the average revenue per free and reduced lunch price student is $1,680. So at $1,600, they're slightly below that average. And as you look down that list, for example, with Minneapolis, you'll see that the free and on average, the free and reduced price lunch student, eligible student, generates $2,482. And in Anoka, if you go down four lines, that generates $1,203. So essentially what's happening is the reduced price kids count as half, and then it goes through the concentration, and that determines how much per free and reduced, not per total, but per free and reduced, and then that's multiplied by the number of free and reduced to get the total revenue.
All right. Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
So again, Mr. Chun, so is it this bringing up the floor and concentrating, watch my language here, establishing more of a floor with the money? The reason that this proposal seems to not emphasize as much deep poverty, because I look, for instance, at Burnsville, 30% more children in deep poverty than Anoka, on a percentage basis at least, but they get no new revenue out of the Newton proposal.
Yeah.
Minneapolis, almost three times the number of children in deep poverty as Anoka, but no new revenue out of the Newton proposal. So we seem to be devaluing deep poverty, students living in deep poverty in this proposal. Am I understanding that correctly because of establishment of the floor?
Mr. Strom?
Representative Dabney, it's always a question, I think, of what in the alternative would happen. There's certainly, under this proposal, there's no reduction to anybody's revenue. So then the question becomes, on the printout, you can see on the top that this spends $69 million. And the question would be, how would that money be distributed differently? Would that be spent differently if it was added to the regular compensatory formula or added to the regular formula? I think that's the question that's faced here. And so this proposal is saying spend that $69 million to bring up the level underneath to make a minimum floor for the amount of compensatory.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Very good. I'm going to ask at this time, well, first of all, I'm going to ask all the all the authors today and testifiers, or at least the point, is we're adding more money to the various school districts. And my question is, one of the goals of the committee, how is that new revenue going to enhance student performance or close the achievement gap, or how is it going to help? Otherwise, what's the sense?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say, and I think I probably differ somewhat from Superintendent Carlson, but from my perspective, that would put more money into our classrooms. We'd be able to reduce class sizes in our district. And I'll let Superintendent Carlson speak, but I'm sure he is concerned more with paying teacher salaries.
Mr. Carlson, how are we going to increase student achievement with these new dollars?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, we're doing really well on that. As the state's largest district, we graduate 3,000 kids. Our achievement gap, 17.5% in reading, the lowest among probably four or five districts in the state. We do well. My concern is we're going to lose ground under the current budget that's before you. I don't know, and I suspect you don't know what the governor is going to come out with later today, but as I sit here, and I shared this the last time I spoke in front of this committee, we're $12 million short for fiscal year 2014. As I sit here, $12 million short. My choice is to cut 250 teachers, because we're in March. We don't know what the July budget is yet. So we are staffing, and we're moving. We're going to take money out of our fund balance. My choice is to either cut 250 teachers or to our 13 bargaining groups, give them a hard freeze. No increase, no steps, no lanes, hard freeze. That's my choice. I understand you're worried about achievement gap. I'm worried about getting through next year and not losing 250 teachers.
Thank you. Is there anyone here in the audience for or against House File 1103? Seeing none, Representative Newton, any closing words?
No, Mr. Chair. I'd simply...
I'm sorry. Representative Quam, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm seeking some clarification in the discussion and in the bill. Bill says eligible. I mean, we're talking eligible. In the discussion, it went over verified or people have filled out the forms. So I'm trying to understand the how the eligible is calculated, because frankly, in Greater Minnesota, there are a lot of districts that probably don't have the issue of people signing up beyond, but people not wanting to come forward and sign. And I noticed that District 4150, Minnesota Online, which I assume if you're online, you probably don't serve lunch, but they do have free and reduced counted. And so I thought that might give us the idea that there is some calculation of eligible in there. And so I'd just like to understand that. If no one comes forward, are they using census data? Are they using whatever additional data to calculate that? And then the compounding thing is, if you're using data globally, how do you compensate for open enrollment out of the district, or you're just saying that's in a noise level?
Mr. Carlson, the term eligible, is that referring to what a demographic study may say, or those that actually apply or fill out the forms?
Mr. Chair, members, they have to fill out the form. They've got to apply. That's the only way we can give them. So they're eligible by the fact of their income. There are ways to check it kind of on a grand scale. We know that Anoka County, for example, is the lowest per capita income in the 7-county metro area. And so you can look at some grand kind of percentages to see that you're in the ballpark and that they're not committing rampant fraud. The other thing, as long as I'm speaking, I would not speak against the concentration of poverty for Minneapolis and St. Paul. They have challenges way beyond what we have. This bill does not take money away from them. And it's real important to know that there. We would say from the compensatory pilot we've had now for 7 years, there's valid rationale behind the concentrations of poverty. So the trick is to get the families to sign up that need it, and particularly at that secondary level. If you want to have a better proxy, as Mr. Strom was kind of alluding to, you're going to have to find something you can just get the numbers from without kind of getting them from the families. In the online case, my guess is they filled out the form, therefore they're eligible, and they would get more money because of that, because that's the way the law reads, I believe.
Representative Newton.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I don't know if we've introduced yet, so I would like to move
very good.
House File 1103.
We do have a quorum now. All right. Move House File 1103 for possible consideration. Any last comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I think this does bring up an interesting discussion that we have to continue with this and, look at this issue of compensatory funding that we've got just one more formula that's broken and needs to be fixed. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you very much. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment. Oftentimes we've heard the term one hand doesn't know what the other one's doing. And with respect to different agencies of government and the policies that have been worked on and put in place for the last several decades, one of the unintended consequences of development patterns in terms of the rules and regulations of how neighborhoods and communities are built has one of the unintended consequences is it has caused the concentrations that you're dealing with some communities favored to the detriment of others. And it should be no surprise that those least able to afford still have the same pursuits and the desires to have home ownership and to enjoy part of the American dream and the American experience, but they have to find it in places that are within their means as opposed to other communities. And so that's just a reflection of what happens in the world of building homes.
Thank you. Layover House File 1103.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Minutes? We could. March 13th minutes. Representative Hertas, would you move those March 13th minutes?
Mr. Chair, I would love to do that. So moved.
Representative Hertas moves the March 13th, 2013 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Next, we'll have House File 755, Representative Barrett. And while he's coming forward, I received another educational little tidbit. Today is Pi Day.
Yes.
Three 14, you know, 3.14. And Representative Erickson, I have to tell one more Chairman Maris story, and you were the author of the bill. And that was that bill back in 2001 that said that boys and girls should not wrestle both against. And I was in support of that bill. And we had in the audience two wrestlers. And so I suggested at the end of the meeting, and we were in room 200, so it had the U like this, because, you know, there's, and I have no problems with girls wrestling girls, guys, but I just, this, you know. So anyway, we're not going to get into that.
I'm sorry, is the chair blushing?
are we being on camera today? So. But I asked Representative Chair Maris, would you mind if the two wrestlers came down and I asked them to demonstrate some moves, just to understand what wrestling's all about and so forth? And he thought for just a second, said yes. And so we had wrestlers doing moves. You remember that, Representative Erickson? So anyway, great moments.
Mr. Yes. Chair, after that I had national press coverage because I had these sports ESPN reporters calling me, asking me about that demonstration and to what extent I was offended or otherwise by that demonstration. So it was pretty amusing.
Yeah, and the two wrestlers, they were very agreeable to do that. They came down and wrestled in front of us, I guess.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, if today is Pi Day, I should point out that next year we'll have an entire month, Pi Month.
This is a smart committee. It really is. Just talking about education, I think, raises the IQ of everybody in the room. Representative Barrett, we have House File 755. Would someone care to move that for Representative Barrett? Representative Erickson, yes, moves House File 755 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, and please present your bill, Representative Barrett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Bob Barrett here on behalf of House File 755, which creates a particular aid called disparity aid that helps those in our state that are low funded. There are several districts in our state that get comparatively low funding compared to other schools in the state. And what this bill would do would be to create a floor upon which if a district is below that floor, they would get bumped up to the floor, and they would receive aid accordingly. The floor under this bill would be 90% of average. So there are quite a few districts that don't get 90% of average in our state. And so this would create that floor. Any district below the floor would get bumped up to the floor. It's a pretty simple bill, just about a page and a half. And I have about four testifiers today who would like to speak on behalf of the bill. Happy to answer any questions about the bill, but I have Brad Lundell here from C who would like to speak to the bill as well.
I think Representative Barrett will have your testifiers, and then there's questions after that. Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director from Schools for Record and Education. I have three witnesses here today. You hear from me plenty, so I'm going to turn it over to them very, very shortly. But I do say we really appreciate Representative Barrett coming forward with this bill. The basic profile of a Schools for Equity in Education district is a district that has a low referendum because of low property tax base, and also a district that does not generate much revenue through the array of categorical formulas that are present in the formula. We don't receive, we're below state average in compensatory, below state average in sparsity. We do have the equity formula that makes up for a little bit of that, but Still, the lagging of the general education formula over time has created a system that has not been advantageous to Schools for Equity and Education districts. I think that Representative Brainerd has talked several times about that balance between categoricals and the general ed formula. We are general education basic formula districts. When that does not keep pace with inflation, we have to go to referendum because we're property poor. The referendum is not something that's going to work long term for us. So with that, I'll turn it over to my witnesses today. Todd Anderson, our president from C, and also the school board member from Rockford, Jerry Hansen, superintendent of the Malacca district, and Dr. Jim Bailey from St. Michael Albertville School District.
Very good. Mr. Anderson, please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am the president of Schools for Equity in Education, also sit on the Rockford School Board. And I first want to start out with, as looking at this bill, it's a good start, and I say start, to equalizing the funding for our school districts. Rockford, we are a property-poor district and have difficulty passing operating levies just because it hits our residents so hard. When I first, I've been on the board, this is my fifth year. When I, my first year on the board, we had failed another levy, and we are forced to cut $1.2 million from our budget, which was about 10% of our budget. We cut out our all our electives for home ec, wood shop, the world languages. We went down to one world language, and I have, if this, if Minnesota was a state where we didn't have open enrollment, I might say that would be fine. But when we have open enrollment in Minnesota, and the residents of our district that can afford to bring their students to other districts, when we are forced to cut, you know, I saw a real fundamental problem with the funding in our and the way the rules were in our state. So when we went down to one world language, we had hardly any electives. We saw a mass exodus, which all of you know what happens then is we just have decreased funding, which it kind of brings us into a tailspin. We have had since then some enrollment back into the district, but I would say that this is a good start, again, to trying to equalize the funding for our districts. And Rockford would be a gain in this, which we would, I think, just according to my simple math, which would be about $175,000, which would bring back a few positions, maybe a few of those programs that we were forced to cut many years ago. So with that being said, thank you for your time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Welcome, if you would identify yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Bailey. I'm superintendent of the St. Michael Albertville School District, and I appreciate, Mr. Chair, the opportunity to speak this morning, as well as to the members of the committee. Every day, our young kindergartners through our seniors that are going to graduate from St. Michael Albertville wake up in the morning, and they come to school, and they attend a great school. They wake up to a community that supports their schools by funding bonds and referendums, even though it costs them two to three times as much as taxpayers in other communities because of our low property wealth. They come to schools with teachers that are highly skilled, and they come to schools and from parents who want only the best for their children. What they don't know when they come to school, and they know many things in coming to school every day, they don't know that just down the road there are students in schools that receive $2,000 more per pupil than the students at St. Michael Albertville. And what they don't know is that funding gap presents significant differences in educational opportunities for them. St. Michael Albertville receives $6,721 per pupil. We are a basic revenue school district, as Mr. Lindell mentioned. That's $2,000 below the state average. Not much, and much below, of course, school districts that are significantly higher at $12,000 or $13,000 a student. Just to give an example, yesterday, we're very proud of our girls' basketball team. They were at the state tournament yesterday, and fortunately they met Hopkins in the first round, an extremely talented team. It was fun to watch. So I'm going to use Hopkins as an example today just because they did beat us yesterday in basketball quite significantly, even though we gave a good try. But for our 6,721 per pupil, Hopkins receives $9,800 per pupil. The bottom line is that students in school districts like Hopkins and others have greater educational opportunities than schools in St. Michael, Albertville. Now, that $6,700 per pupil includes $700 that our local taxpayers have supported in a referendum. Again, even though it means they're paying 2 to 3 times as much in property taxes as those in the Hopkins school districts for that same $700. Even with that $700 added for a total of the $6,700, that still ranks us in the bottom 10 school districts in the state of Minnesota. So even after a community has made a commitment and paying more taxes, we're still, even with that additional $700, we're still in the bottom. As was mentioned by Mr. Lindell, we're a basic aid school. We survive on whatever gets added to the basic formula. So as in the current proposal from the governor, that's 1% has happened the last couple years. We appreciate that because we realize that came in great difficult economic times. But that 1% and the previous to that, no increases. You compound that with the basic school with the fact that just due to inflation over the last 10 years, we've lost $1,000 in purchasing power. The governor's task force had recommended kind of trying to catch up a little bit with that with about $250, although that wasn't forwarded from the task force. I recently came here, this isn't held against me, from Iowa. I've been in your state 3 years, have greatly enjoyed the opportunity to be here. And it's kind of interesting coming from another state to notice the differences. And so you can ask naive and kind of dumb questions sometimes because you just don't know why things are done the way they are. So I noticed that one of the things that Minnesota has is many categorical programs. And like I said, we don't qualify for those. But what I also noticed is that many of those categorical programs are in place due to advocacy by districts that have certain characteristics of students, certain characteristics of their school districts, sparsity. Certainly some that, I would say certainly have very much legitimacy. We talked earlier, I heard you talk about concentrations of poverty, and certainly understand that factor. But I think there's also a factor, when you have so many categorical programs, it does, you're making choices every day between the basic formula and those categorical programs. And I'm here to advocate for a balance in that. Recognizing that there are some important pieces. But I'm also here to advocate for the students of St. Michael Albertville who don't have those benefits of some of those extra dollars that come through those categorical programs. With less basic aid, with being a basic aid school, our property taxpayers are asked to take on more responsibilities. And I mentioned that's 2 to 3 times as much as other property taxpayers. And again, to pick on Hopkins as an example, not because I'm a sore loser, but I'm just trying to pick on them today. But if both school districts assessed the maximum levy, $1,633, the taxpayers in Hopkins per $100,000 assessed value, their taxpayers would pay $153 per $100,000 for that $1,633. The taxpayers in St. Michael Albertville will pay $500 per $1,000 assessed value because of that, which obviously means our taxpayers can only ask our local taxpayers to make up so much of that difference. So why does that matter? Why does this disparity matter?
Superintendent Bailey, could you finish just a minute
here? I certainly will.
We have one more testifier, and this is very, very good testimony, but we
sure.
Got other
I will.
Bills.
I will.
All right, thank you.
Why does this matter? It matters not only for the schools, which I'm here to advocate for, but it also matters for our cities. If we have higher taxes, if we cannot offer those educational opportunities as other communities, obviously we're not as attractive. We operate a real lean organization, and I share that with you because we can talk about cuts and what does that mean. As a lean organization, for 5,600 students, my district office is made up of me, a human resources director, a half-time curriculum coordinator, a half-time assessment coordinator, and a staff development person that deals with Title I and many other programs. So we have 5 people in our district office, hardly a large. amount of district people. Yesterday, when we talked about our capital budget, we were talking about not adding mobile technology and wireless to our school district. We were talking about getting enough seats in our cafeteria and spending money on chairs and seats and how much outdated material can we do. The bottom line for us is that the simple truth is that no matter how the St. Michael Albertville School District conducts its own business over the next few years, there is no magical combination of spending cuts or levy measures that can overcome the inevitable and continued increases in class sizes and losses in educational opportunities. We won't be able to sustain the successes we've had. We will have and continue to have now, and we'll have less, fewer music, art, activity programs, outdated technology, less help for struggling learners, and fewer AP and rigorous courses.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Bailey. And while you might have lost the basketball game yesterday, congratulations on your Class 3A co-state champions as wrestling team.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So, and that's the only sport that really matters.
When I heard you talk about wrestling, yeah.
So,
well, there'd be some in St. Michael Albertville that would say that, too.
And I go back a ways with a former head coach, Greg Greeno.
Oh, Greg, yes.
Absolutely. He was at Jamestown and Jamestown College.
Yeah, he still teaches for us, an outstanding math person. Yes.
Very good.
Thank you very
excellent
much.
Excellent program there. Thank you so much. And so, would you please introduce yourself?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Hansen, Superintendent of Schools in Malacca. I'm here to speak on behalf of Representative Barrett's bill, and I urge you to please support this bill. Malacca, like districts across central Minnesota, I can go to Hinckley, Sandstone, come all the way across the state, keep going west, go to St. Michael Albertville, and the numbers may be different, but the issue's the same. We're a property-poor school district. In other words, the value of our property is significantly less than the value of property in many, many other school districts across the state. This results in a tax burden that is 2 to 5 times greater for the citizens in our area when we compare it to citizens in other parts of the state. We are in the bottom 10 to 15% when it comes to funding per pupil for students across East Central Minnesota. Malacca does have an operating levy, $1.02. It passed by a 60% to 40%. That means 40% felt they couldn't come up with 25 cents a month on a $100,000 home. It's not because they don't support their schools. It's not because they don't think education is important. It's not because they don't want their children to be successful. When I talk about levies and operating levies with my community, I don't talk about you just have to give up a large pizza and going out for dinner. They've given that up. I talk about the price of milk and the price of gasoline, the price of propane to heat their home. Students from our area are going to compete for jobs and for colleges, not just with people from Foley, not just with our colleagues and their friends from Princeton, but from across the state, across the country, and around the globe. That's who we need to prepare our children for. Please, do not let the educational opportunity for our students be bypassed because of where they live. At that, please support Representative Barrett's bill. I thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Hansen. Questions? And we, Representative Palm, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am intrigued with this bill. Both of the school districts are wholly within my boundaries of my district. Are even below St. Michael Albertville. In fact, one of my resident district only has one regular school district that would gain more money per student than it. And so I'm very familiar with being able to have to do with much less than the state average. And this and the previous bill really show that the formula maybe needs to, instead of Band-Aids, really needs a look at it and a fix. Because, as we've heard today, there are districts that are looking at getting rid of a large number of teaching staff. classroom staff, because of the way the formula is maybe not appropriately distributing. So as we look at these to be laid over, I would hope that the members of the committee and the chair look at the possibility of going beyond the Band-Aid and a new coat of paint and actually try to dig into a bit of reform.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good to see you, Superintendent Hansen, and Superintendent David as well. I think you hit it right exactly on the point that we really need to consider, and that's the categoricals are driving this disparity, because across East Central Minnesota, as Superintendent Hansen mentioned, we're all in the same boat. You know, our student populations are basically not populations where we would receive much in any of the categorical areas to make up for the difference that we experience in our part of the state to Minneapolis, Anoka, Hennepin, you know, those districts. Unless we do major reform of the formula, of the entire education funding formula, and I know the task force attempted to do that, we are not going to solve this problem. This disparity revenue, Representative Barrett, is great, but it's just going to be temporary, because we're going to reach that point again where we're going to be in the same situation of having this disparity among our districts. So, I like this proposal. I certainly would support it. But I also know that it's not the answer to what's our dilemma. And our dilemma is growing categoricals in areas that help some districts but don't help others because of the design of the categoricals. So just a comment, Mr. Chair, and I hope that one of these days we will actually do something that's revolutionary and change the education funding so that it is without all of these Band-Aids, as Representative Quam alluded to, a fair system across the state.
Thank you. I have four people to ask questions. We'll take those four, and then we're going to go to the audience and then move on. So Representative Radenovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to say to Representative Barrett, I appreciate your bill. I'm actually a co-author on this. The situation that your districts find yourselves in is very similar to the districts that I represent. We've seen over the last dozen years cuts to half our industrial tech programs, to languages, to art, to band, to choir, to sports, to just about everything. And, you know, I understand that the students in our area are going to have a very difficult time competing against students from, you know, areas with more affluent schools. You know, the concern for me is that I think, you know, based on the working group reports, based on some of the suggestions that have been out there, that one of the primary drivers between the disparities in school districts is the disparity in the property tax value of those school districts. And so, I've seen a variety of proposals that would try to address that. Now, we have, a dilemma before us as a body, and the governor in some ways sort of highlighted it for us, that right now, we, as a state, face a $627 million deficit. We've got $800 million left on our school shift from the previous biennium. And the governor has a plan that I think pays that out to about 2016 or 2017. If you were to consider that there are some people who would like to pay that off immediately, right away, and then there are also, you know, other investments that people would like to be seen, I guess my question is, do you have guidance on what you would do and how you would make up that difference for the $56 million that's on the table for this bill in 2014?
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Chair Marquardt and Representative Radenovich. First of all, I want to say that as much as I'm a basketball fan, our Chisago Lakes Wildcats are in the tournament today, and they will win today.
Very good. Best of wishes there, Representative Barrett.
Yes. You, since you're just such a great wrestling fan, I am a huge wrestling fan. I just want you to know that. Because this bill will be laid over, and it will be included in a lot of other decisions that the
Keep
chair
talking, Representative Barrett.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think I'm going the right direction. I'm not sure. You bring up a good point regarding the shift. The shift being $2 billion back in 2010, that's what we inherited when we got in 10. We added to it, and now it's gone down to less than $1 billion. What a lot of folks don't know, and I didn't know this when I got in, is that the interest rate that school districts get that money, they get it from a bank. It's called an aid anticipation certificate. And from what I understand, the interest rate on that aid anticipation certificate is about 0.5%. And so you add the fees, and it becomes less than 1%. So school districts are unfortunately paying interest on that money, a very low amount. I probably defer to the superintendents as to what they would prefer, but I understand that a lot of superintendents need more money. They need more money to operate. And so we're caught. We're caught in a dilemma here. We should pay down that shift. It was, you know, not good practice. Private sector folks don't do that. But we have a dilemma. So that's unfortunately or fortunately, Chair Marquardt will have to be making that decision what he puts in the omnibus bill. We've heard testimony from a lot of folks who don't get the money. I represent North Branch on a 4-day school week. This would help them tremendously. It would allow them to have a 5-day week, something that most districts think is normal. It's not normal where I come from. 4-day week is the standard now in the North Branch School District. So I'm not answering your question very well, but I'm not the chair of the committee either, so I don't know that I need to. Certainly we have more money this year compared to last year, so there is more money, more tax revenue, which could help. There are also other decisions we make with our current resources that could be made, all kinds of ways to afford this because it's so important to so many districts.
Quick follow-up.
Yep, quick follow-up. Yeah, I appreciate Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett. I appreciate your comment. And again, you know, I think this bill basically sort of hits, you know, one of our problems right on the head, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be for Mr. Strom, but there are a whole series of districts listed on this spreadsheet that indicate they're getting $6,590 in disparity revenue. But are these charters, but they have no pupils, and they have a lot of nonsense information in the middle.
Mr. Strom clarifies nonsense. That, Representative Reinhart, that is indeed nonsense. Districts that don't have a pupil count are showing up getting that allowance, but when we're multiplying it by the pupil count, if you go one column to the left, you'll see it's turning out to be zero. So what's happening is when a charter school closes, we carry it for a year or two because there's some data outstanding for that. But so it shows as if they're getting that amount, but it's times a zero.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Two questions. One for Superintendent Bailey. Superintendent, I don't mean to pick at a scab, but you brought up Hopkins a few times. The state average, since we were talking about this in the previous bill, is 30% of students qualifying for free lunch and 7% for reduced price lunch. Mm-hmm. Hopkins is just below the state average, 28% qualify mm-hmm. for free, 4% mm-hmm. for reduced price. St. Michael Albertville, 9% mm-hmm. qualify for free lunch, 5% for reduced price. So Hopkins has 300% more kids in deep poverty than St. Michael Albertville. Does that affect the education challenges and opportunities between your district and Hopkins?
Sure. Superintendent Bailey?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I said in my testimony, I think there needs to be a balance between categorical programs. This bill doesn't bring school districts like ourselves even up to the average. And quite frankly, I'm fine with that for the very reasons you've mentioned. We don't have the higher number of poverty. There are other categorical areas that we don't qualify for. So I fully support the fact that there's going to be categorical programs, and one of those is going to be based on free and reduced lunch and concentrations of poverty. What I'm just advocating for today is that there be a balance, that there be a recognition that for those of us who don't qualify for those programs, the 1% increase in the basic formula is not going to maintain the current programs that we have. So absolutely, there are differences in educational needs. I just don't want the fact that there are many of our school districts like ourselves that are basic formula schools.
Representative Dabney? Did you have another question?
I do. For the author, and I may come back to another question for Representative, or excuse me, Superintendent Bailey. The chair here has stressed outcome measures. What, you know, if we're going to fund, what are we going to get back for it? With this new formula that you're proposing, what is the outcome measure? How would we know that this was being successful?
Sure.
Representative Barrett, that's a question actually I asked Representative Newton. I was going to ask everyone with the new money, how will this improve student achievement?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Representative Dabney. I would defer to the superintendents here for their own individual situation because the money would be put into their districts differently and be used for different things. But I know I do represent North Branch, and we are in a four-day school week. So we have young kindergartners, first graders, second graders spending an hour more each day in class. It gets pretty tiring when you're spending 5-6 hours in class when you're 6-7 years old. So we have kids who would be able to enjoy what is normal for almost every district in the state, which is a five-day week education spread out over an appropriate period of time so they can learn gradually. We also would have reduced class sizes. You know, we have certain classes in the districts that have over 30 kids. And so we have lower class sizes, which will help education. Those are two examples, but I would like to defer to the superintendents who know their districts much more than I do.
I think we're going to defer on that. I appreciate that. I think you've hit some good ones right on the head. Do you have
one more quick question for the
superintendent? Okay, very good, Representative Dabney.
Superintendent Bailey, under this proposal, you would get $315 per pupil.
Correct.
Under the governor's recommendation, you would get $341. Which would you prefer?
Superintendent Bailey.
Both.
Both. Yeah, there we go.
Representative.
More seriously, let me answer the question.
Thank you.
Okay. The question.
Go ahead.
Basic, and I think it goes back to Representative Erickson said, for basic formula schools, the formula does not work for us. I think that's the piece. I'm fully open to discussions about how we would, what's the best way to put that money if it's on the base. Now my guess is, without looking specifically, that $300 and some in the governor's proposal probably also includes money for special education. Mm-hmm. So this proposal does not. Mm-hmm. And so if we take special ed out of the formula, I would say probably 80% of that governor's proposal will go help fund our special education deficit, that we our $400 of crossover subsidies. If I could take just one liberty.
I
was just going to tell you how we would improve student achievement. So.
Okay, very good. We can't let that go.
thank you. I have very specific measures.
That number went to one, the top of the list. Go
number
ahead.
One is we have looked at how we can increase our industrial technology department. We hear about manufacturing and the need for skilled manufacturers. We have a very strong foundation. Our district has built facilities for that, and we are committed to doing that. We have already committed to exceed the state standard in regard to science that said you have to have biology and or physics or chemistry. Our graduating classes now have to have all three. It isn't an and or. And the last one is math. We are committed to increasing our math percentage of math students 5% over the next 4 years and the percent proficient.
Thank you very much. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick things. One follow-up with regard to the apparent low cost of money, but even when we carry large shift balances, that ends up still being real money in terms of cost to schools. And recently I read it's as much as $100 million, and it could be even more if the shift is more in the $2 billion range. So, you know, these it's kind of like having a credit card and letting that balance grow, and the interest keeps accumulating, and it really doesn't do much for the consumers. So I just wanted to address that issue. But I want to thank you for your bill, Representative Barrett, because I think it does, unlike the characterization of it being a Band-Aid, I'd prefer to call it a bridge. We do need reform and make a difference with the funding formula. And I'd like to point out, with respect to my previous comments about development patterns, nothing is probably more stark as an example of the Senate District that I represent. And here we have 11 school districts serving Senate District 33. More than half of them are C schools, and the other one is our AMSD. And to illustrate the dynamic that Mr. Anderson, president of C, was trying to articulate is, you know, within the district we have the development patterns that have been influenced by regional government prohibiting development and causing low-density development and low-tax capacity. We have these school districts operating on the fringe, and we've got formulas, you know, for the AMSD schools like West Tonka, Orono, Osseo, and Wayzata. We've got funding, you know, in the $7,200 to $8,000 range. Then right next door, we've got funding based on the same system where they're only getting $6,200 to $6,300, $6,400. It makes it very convenient when the school district right next door has so much more resources, and we see this open exodus of open enrollment and students leaving the district. So this is one of the problems we need to fix, and if we can fix it, yes, it will help in terms of the kids, but the intangible benefit of this is that you create stronger community by there is a strong correlation, there is a nexus between strong schools, strong property values, and community. So when all of those are employed, then you have communities that are growing and able to sustain their own schools and aren't here groveling for money. So that's the interplay.
Thank you. Is there anyone here in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 755? Seeing none? Oh, excuse me. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Mary Ciccone, Parents United. I just want to point out that Representative Quam and Representative Erickson have nailed it on the head. After 2 years of the funding task force and 10 years of tons of funding task forces, what we have found is the more categoricals we build into the formula, the more we thread money apart. We need to get that funding formula up so that it's close to the average of what it actually costs. The more we develop more categoricals, the more threading apart we do of districts, regions of our state, that is not the way to go. So unless we say yes to this bill and yes to the next several categoricals, we're doing the exact same thing. You are Solomon. You're trying to decide what region wins and what region doesn't. Could we stop that, and could we please put money on the formula and make it work? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else from the audience? Representative Barrett, you have the last word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the discussion today. It's a very important topic, as you've heard. There are 17 co-authors on the bill, meaning it has wide bipartisan support. I want to channel Representative Hertaz here, who mentioned a bridge. The actual name of the bridge is Bridge to Equity in Education Funding, BEEF. And so a lot of the low-funded districts in the state want to know, where's the beef?
Thank you. Very good. I like
well played, sir.
Representative Hertaus renews his motion to lay over House File 755 for possible consider. Thank you very much, Representative Barrett.
Yeah, that was my motion.
I'm sorry, Representative Erickson has the motion. Sorry.
Thank you.
Very good. Sorry about that. Representative Erickson's motion. All right. We have two bills left. I think House File 393 is actually going to go fairly quick, but we're not going to do that one yet. Do you have testifiers here for
three? Yes, I do.
How many testifiers do you have?
Two, okay, but I bet they can be really fast.
Very good. Well, we're going to go to House File 383.
Thank you.
How many testifiers do you have?
Two, but I bet they can be really fast.
Very good. Well, we're going to go to House File 383. We've got Representative Benson. We'll go to this bill. I do want to hear both these bills yet, so I would ask everyone, testifiers, to be very quick and to the point. And who would like to move House File 383? Representative Seltzer moves House File 383 for be laid over for possible inclusion. There is an A3 amendment. It's really a technical amendment that just changes. I'm sorry, this is the author's amendment.
Yes.
And this is on line 2.30, members, on the bill, line 2.30.
No.
The A3 amendment.
And then there's a technical amendment to the amendment.
All right. So there is an A3 amendment. Representative Zelzer, will you move the A3 amendment? Representative Zelzer moves the A3 amendment. Thank you. Any discussion? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And so now we need a technical oral amendment to the amendment, and that is on line 2.30. And insert the word or after the word zero. So it should say the greater of zero or. So a letter, the word or after the zero. So we have a Representative Zelzer makes that motion.
Yes, I do.
Any discussion? If not, we'll vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Amendment. The amendment is adopted. Representative Benson.
Good morning, Chair Marquardt and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to present this bill and the discussion about this morning, and hope we'll meet with your approval. And I assume this will also be laid over. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the motion, be laid over.
Right. Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I represent parts of three public school districts. One which you heard about already this morning, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Wayzata are the three school districts. My interest in offering this bill is to highlight a number of school public school funding issues that are often absent from our discussion of school finance. And without going too far afield, this gives me an opportunity to discuss one of them before we get to the bill. And that has to do with the increasing reliance on operating referendums. This has caused a problem for many districts. My districts, for example, have been able to maintain their educational standards by constantly going back to the public and seeking referendums. And we've been lucky and fortunate, not only because of the parents and the communities being strong supporters of public education, but also because they have a tax base which can sustain these. But we know that operating referendums were not supposedly going to be such a major funding source. So I just want to mention that, because the Constitution clearly states that we are to have a general and uniform system of public schools, and that we should make provisions based on taxation and otherwise obscure a thorough and efficient system of public schools. And I'm just kind of paraphrasing the state constitution, Article 13, Section 1. The Location Equity Index proposal, which the chair and several members here are well aware of, was championed by the former chair of this committee, Chair Mindy Greiling. So I'm carrying this forward, since she's not here, to continue pushing this idea. There are a whole series of categorical aids which the legislature has found useful in helping districts. I'm not challenging any of them, and I'm not also asking for any additional revenue. So that should be a good response, hopefully, from the committee. But I'd just like to use Minnetonka, and we have the superintendent from Minnetonka here today, to look at very briefly some of these categoricals. And I think everyone has in their packet two pages showing categoricals, one with and one without referendums. And if we just look at the Minnetonka list, for example, under extended day, Minnetonka receives $3, the average is 76. Compensatory revenue, Minnetonka receives 14, the average is 511. Limited English proficiency or learning, English learning I think it's now called, $7, average 42. Small schools, 0, average 17. Operating sparsity, 0, average 26. Transportation sparsity, having to do with, you know, geographical concerns. Zero, average 64. Operating capital, here we do better, 210, 206. And, of course, this is based on facilities, capital needs, and also based on the age of the buildings, I believe. And, Mr. Chair, you are so knowledgeable about all this, so when I make an error, I hope you will help correct it. Equity revenue, $81, average $97. Gifted and talented, $12. Transition revenue, $1, average $31. Subtractions, $31, average $32. So we gained a dollar there. A combination of three categories having to do with charter schools and schools, 13-0.
Representative Benson?
Well, that gives you the point.
You've made the point.
I have made the point.
Very well. We do have some testifiers, I know.
So. Yes, I do.
Okay. So, Mr. Kroonquist?
Mr. Chairman, Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll be real brief. I know time is tight, but we want to thank Representative Benson for bringing this forward. The location equity revenue idea is something that has been supported in numerous studies and reports over the last decade, starting with Governor Pawlenty's task force back in 2002, which followed up by the PS Minnesota group that continued that work, the new Minnesota Miracle legislation, and most recently the Commissioner's Funding Task Force. All included a recommendation that this was an area that should be part of the formula, we should recognize it, and we should not say that the metro districts have to go out and pass a referendum to recognize what is a very identifiable cost differential. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, and turn it over to the other testifiers.
Thanks. Very good. Would you... Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself. And
thank you, Mr.
And if
Chair.
I could ask you just to get really to the point.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I've just been called in. We're having some major bills on the outdoor heritage funding, and they are all roll calls. And I've just been called, if I may be excused a moment.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Benson. Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of Schools in Minnetonka, and I will try to really help you out with my time. You've heard some of the points that have been made by Representative Benson and Mr. Kroonquist. This is a factor that should be considered in our overall picture. It's not a categorical. It should be part of the overall view of school finance in Minnesota. And it's probably the most important factor that's not currently in the law. You look at equity or equalization, you look at equity, you look at decline enrollment, you look at sparsity, you have a lot of factors, and this is one of the most important factors that's not considered. And there is a major inequity in our system because it's not being considered. There are parts of our state that have between 20% and 25% higher costs for the same services, because of the cost factors of doing business in that part of the state. And as Mr. Kroonquist said, we've had several studies over the years. AMSD has spent about 10 years working on this issue. Myers and Augenblick, on behalf of the state, looked at these factors back in 2006. Hamline University School of Business looked at these variables. Although they did not have a recommended solution for it, they identified the differences. And further complicating the problem, in my view, is that the state is actually, because they're not recognizing this, they're actually providing less funding to those districts that have this higher cost through a variety of tools that you have available, some of which Representative Benson has cited. But these costs are driven by wage differentials in the regions, housing differentials in the regions, and we have to acknowledge that in our districts that are serving in the metro and some of the urban centers that are out in the rest of the state. For example, in Hamlin,
could you finish up here? I think we understand the point. Could you finish up here in just a couple seconds, please?
Certainly will.
Thank you.
I'm just going to say that virtually all of the difference between the metro districts and many outstate districts is paid through the local referendum. So if you really, even the cap on referendums is not high enough to be recognizing the differential that should be there. So I certainly support the effort to take $400 of the levy, recognize that that's part of the differential, and leave the cap alone, and that this bill starts down the path of providing this level of equity.
Thank you so much, and I apologize for making things a little shorter here, but we're trying to hit a time deal, so thank you. You'd please introduce
good morning, yourself. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Tolp, the Director of Business Services at Hopkins Public Schools. 14 and a half years at school district in West Central Minnesota, living through some of the issues that you just heard about earlier, finishing up my eighth year at Hopkins. Was very interested in the support that Mr. Daphne gave us earlier when we were talking about Hopkins. But just real quickly, as I've lived out in the rural community and I started working at Hopkins, the differences are real. I will tell you that. They were stark for me, actually, when I came to Hopkins. One of the reasons that, a couple reasons why I think you should support this bill, recognition, as Mr. Benson, Dr. Peterson, and Mr. Kroonquist said, it's been verified that there is a difference. The second part is it's revenue neutral. It's not going to cost the state any money, won't cost local taxpayers any money. And the third reason why is it was a recommendation of the School Finance Working Group. And just real quickly on that, from my perspective, the School Finance Working Group had a lot of recommendations that were good. It would have increased the taxes in the Hopkins School Districts by 11.8%, and we would have only gotten a revenue increase in that proposal of about 6%. So there's always going to be some trade-offs, but if you want my opinion, I think the body here should have considered that proposal in its entirety and put it up or down. Thank you
very much. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know time is of the essence here, but Mr. Strom, can you explain to us how this wonderful bill is levy and revenue neutral?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Woodard, the governor's recommendation was revenue neutral. Under this proposal, there's a slight increase to funding for a few school districts that have less than the amount of referendum that's being subtracted. So they're actually, under this, picking up a very small amount of money. It's essentially moving it from one category to another, though, of equalized revenue for everyone else. But there's a very small number of districts. You can see on the second printout that you were passed out on that there's, in the column that shows the new money there, there's a few districts that get new money. So that's a slight difference than the governor's recommendation.
I've got one question from each side, so I'm going to not take those. I apologize. But is there anyone in the audience who is for or against House File? What number are we on here? 383 as amended.
Mr. Chairman, Sam Waltzeff, Minnesota Rural Education. I'll try and be very brief. In an effort to make my high school geometry teacher very proud, 2 years from today will be truly be pi year. It'll be 314.15 if you really want to do the math.
No, I think it's one.
Anyway, Chase Long, good teacher, best geometry teacher in the world. As was mentioned by the previous witness, this is part of the Education Finance Reform Task Force. One component is missing from this, and it would have made a perfect day if we had another 15 minutes to hear House File 1406. But I think that bill is going to be up next Tuesday on talking about a $300 roll-in for all districts across the state of Minnesota. There's a lot to say about the concept of location equity, driving salaries based on county wage data. I do appreciate Representative Benson's amendment here today. It does fit within what MREA had agreed within that task force report. It's just missing one component, but I think you're going to hear that next week. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else here to testify for or against?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alsweiger, Education Minnesota. Just very briefly, I think you've heard today people coming and looking at their own certain school district and the demographics and the funding situation, and individuals are coming up to give their story about how things need to be changed. We think it needs to be more comprehensive than plugging the holes to fix the problem. Everybody needs more money for education, and until we really reform the education funding system, we're going to have this problem. With the funding, the local location equity index, we think that the teachers around the state might be treated less fairly than they even they are right now because of their ability to pass levy referendums, because of the extra funding for some of these districts. So we'd ask you to take a more comprehensive look at this funding problem.
Thank you very much. Anyone in the audience for or against? Representative Benson, I appreciate your great advocacy as always for your districts. Anything you have?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a well-written diatribe about the whole issue of funding and the base formula. You know, if I were a king, I would put all the money on the base formula, let the local districts work their will. That's not going to happen. There are a lot of differentials and issues that affect individual districts. So again, this bill is not attacking any of the other categoricals. They all have reason. That's for another day. My bill is not part of that. But my districts do, and all the metropolitan districts and outstate population centers do face a differential in the cost of living, particularly housing. And I'm simply asking that that be recognized. I am following at least part of what the department is proposing. And I wish Representative Anzils, is he a member of this committee?
Yeah.
I wish he was here because I had noticed that Grand Rapids, for example, would benefit from this, as would Brooklyn Center and a number of other districts. In the case of my districts, it simply gives them flexibility. Since we elect school boards, let's let them make decisions and let's let the voters there decide whether they were wise or not. So this is local control and a little loosening of the restraints that the state has placed on districts like mine. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Benson. Representative Salzer renews her motion to lay over. House File 383 is amended for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. Members, we're going to go over a few minutes, but I do want to hear House File 393. Representative Morgan, would you move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I will move House File 393 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Very good. We did talk about compensatory revenue earlier, so I just get right to where are we changing that?
Members, if you like the idea of closing the achievement gap, which I think we all do, and if you think that getting parents more engaged, particularly parents of at-risk students more engaged, this is your bill. What we will do is we will expand the opportunity to use some more of compensatory revenue outside of the school building where it is generated in order to provide preparation for early education, for especially in terms of engaging parents of these at-risk students. I have with me Vicki Roy, a former school board member in District 191, and a member of Alliance for Student Achievement, and Tom Amhofer, who is our community education director, and they would like to speak very briefly, I've asked them.
Very good. Thank you very
about
much.
The bill.
Ms. Roy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Morgan said, my name is Vicki Roy. I'm happy to be here today to tell you about some exciting things that are going on. I also co-chair an early literacy committee in our community that's identified improving the third grade reading proficiency measure in our school district as an area for our whole community to work on. And over the past 10 years, as you may know, my school district has experienced dramatic demographic changes, as have many other school districts in the state. Once a school district with fewer than 20% of students qualifying for free and reduced price meals, today we are a school district proudly serving a racially, ethnically, and economically diverse population of students. Nearly 50% of our students identify themselves as non-white, 50% qualify for free and reduced price meals, and 24% speak a first language other than English. I could go into a lot of other pieces. I'm not going to do that. Simply to tell you that we are a very changing school district. Mr. Umhofer.
Thank you very much. If you'd introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tom Umhofer. I am the community education director, and we've spent a great deal of time here cutting our testimony down quite a bit. I apologize if it's choppy. I spent 2.5 years in Mankato prior to coming to the Burnsville Public Schools. And in that time in Mankato, we worked on a program to address those very needs of incoming kindergarten students. Over 50% of our students were not ready in many critical areas, including social, emotional, motor, literacy, and math development. There are many studies that show children who drop out of high school, half of those who dropped out were behind before they even entered a kindergarten classroom. Many of those children never end up making up their achievement gap. And we know by research that by age three, there's already a substantial achievement gap between the economically disadvantaged and advantaged children in vocabulary and print concepts. And it's very common to find a kindergarten classroom with children at a three-year-old level and an eight-year-old level, which is a five-year gap. In Burnsville and when I was in Mankato, we've looked at ways to address these needs of making sure that our incoming kindergartners are ready. In Burnsville, we have expanded our efforts to prepare all of our students to be college and career ready, and increasingly aware that the experiences that a child has at home before they enter into kindergarten has a tremendous impact on their academic performances and throughout their student career. We know that there's a significant correlation between parents reading to their children every day and a child's reading ability, and yet in this country only 1 in 2 parents read to their children daily and 1 in 10 admit to never reading to their children. Decades of research show that when parents are involved in guiding their child's learning at home, students have higher grades, higher test scores, and higher graduation scores. School attendance is better, students have increased motivation to excel, and there are fewer disciplinary referrals. To finalize my part, Children's Reading Foundation has created a curriculum for parents to target readiness skills prior to entering kindergarten, and the findings from their studies are showing considerable amounts of saving in remedial costs, those monies that could be reinvested in the early years to help parents and incoming students be more prepared for their academic career. And I would urge you to consider passing House File 393 for this reason, to better allocate some of our compensatory dollars to help provide that critical link to helping our families and our students get an early start in their early years so they can be even more successful during their school career.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate that. Ms. Roy.
Piece. We want you to know that we're not asking for more money. We're asking for flexibility in how we can use that money. And we also want you to know that as a community, we are working to find ways to help fund this. We're holding a fundraiser next Tuesday evening within our community. Our mayors, chamber executives, and many business people are going to be there to hear about the program, and several of them are going to talk about the help they've already given us. So once again, we know that it's important to support the children who are struggling academically in a lot of ways, and we believe that being able to use our funding, our compensatory funding, and make some decisions on our own will help all students to be able to do better in school. The language revisions in House File 393, as I said, do not ask for more money, but rather grant school districts the authority to invest some of their revenue in a child's first teacher, their parents.
Thank you very much. Anyone here in the audience for or against House File 383? If anyone wants, I know we're over, but if anyone wants a question here, and like I said, if this bill makes it into the omnibus bill, there'll be plenty of time for more discussion on that. Representative Morgan, then, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I apologize again but thank you so much for your testimony, and we'll you renew the layover, House File 383 for possible inclusion. Members, thank you. We learned a lot today. We're adjourned.